In a world torn apart by wars over oil, many are naturally looking for alternative sources of energy. And sadly, among politicians, their leading choice seems to be nuclear. Among the myths that have been spread over the years about nuclear-powered electricity are that it does not cause global warming or pollution, thus clean and green, that it is inexpensive, and that it is safe. But what are the facts? The world's leading spokesperson for the anti-nuclear movement, Dr. Helen Caldicott, is the co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, and the 2003 winner of the Lannan Cultural Freedom Prize. She divides her time between Australia and Washington, D.C., where she recently established the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. She is also, as I said, a co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Welcome, Helen Caldicott.
Hey, Terry.
I always like listeners to get a little feel for the people behind the ideas and the work and so on. So, did you start as a physician?
Yeah.
Tell me about that and how you transmuted into an international advocate.
Oh, well, I read a book called On the Beach when I was 15, which was turned into a film with Fred Astaire and Ava Gardner. It was about a nuclear war and everyone in the world died except people in Melbourne, Australia, which was so far south, and described how eventually they were engulfed in the radiation and they died vomiting and bleeding to death. And the end of the film, you know, the beautiful streets of Melbourne were still there, a blind gently flapping in the breeze, but that was the end of life on Earth. And I was 15 and I lost my virginity. I was never the same again. And being of curious disposition, I just read everything I could find about nuclear weapons. And then when I was 17, I entered medical school, which was free for 6 years. And I learned about radiation and Drosophila fruit fly. There's a man called Muller who irradiated Drosophila fruit fly, who reproduce every few days. So he can watch a gene for a crooked wing induced by radiation that goes on generation to generation. And at the time, 1956, Russia and America were just going hell for leather, blowing up bombs in the atmosphere. And for the life of me, I could not comprehend what they were doing or why, because the fallout was coming down. Linus Pauling said children would get leukemia and the genetic implications were obvious. And so I spoke at university, but it's a very sexist country, Australia, and my colleagues, most of them were men, I was one of the few women in my year, didn't listen to me. They continued playing their poker. So I didn't do anything. Then I came to America in 66 for 3 years to be with my now ex-husband, and I got a job at Harvard Medical School and I trained in cystic fibrosis, but I also had three babies. And I was revolutionized by living here. The civil rights movement was on, Martin Luther King was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, the anti-Vietnam War movement and flower power and the whole thing was on. Nixon was elected, and I learnt how a working democracy operates. I've devoured the New York Times every day, and I went home in 1969 to find that the French in 71 were testing bombs in the Pacific. We were receiving a lot of fallout, so I wrote a letter to the paper and they didn't print it, so I rang up the editor and said, "Where's my letter?" And he said, "Well, we get hundreds a day," very condescending. I said, "Yeah, but mine's important." And he published it. And the next day I was asked to speak on television, like on, you know, the equivalent of the McNeil Lehrer show. And I led the movement, and it was just serendipity. I was a rusty doctor and I, you know, I'd learned how to treat CF. I'd been at Harvard. And, you know, in 9 months, 75% of Australians rose up and said, "We won't have those bloody French blowing up their bloody bombs in the Pacific because we swear a lot." And I didn't know, but the Australians didn't like the French. They think they're arrogant. I love the French wine, the French food, you know, the French fashions, but, you know, it was an incredible movement, and I learnt what President Jefferson once said: an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. So I was radicalised, if you like, by living in America. I learnt what a real democracy really means.
What's interesting, actually, to someone who actually was at Harvard at that same time.
Were you?
Yeah, I was there from 65.
What were you studying?
I studied social relations, which was sociology.
Oh, really?
And social psychology.
Right.
And I started an alternative high school and was in on the building takeover in 1969 and all of that sort of thing. But it's interesting, you say that it was because you were in America that you learned what a practicing democracy means. I think it's because you were here in those years.
Yes.
It was more about the time than the place.
Oh, those years were absolutely magical.
Yeah.
And people had the guts to stand up and speak the truth. Where are they now? I mean, I don't I see hardly anyone with any guts at the moment. What's happened?
Well, the key thing in terms of the anti-war movement was there's no draft.
I know.
And very cleverly so.
Yep.
Even though it actually means it's costing our soldiers more.
Oh, they don't care about that. Cannon fodder. Who cares about... You know, many of them now, they're recruiting mentally retarded people. They're recruiting people with physical disabilities. Young kids that have died. You know, my next book's going to be called Why Men Kill. And I'm going to write about why society glorifies killers. Why do they glorify war when if someone murders someone, they're in jail and they may even be killed? So it's an interesting concept. And why do women sit by and let the men kill? You know, what is it all about? So that'll be fun. I'm dedicating it to Donald Rumsfeld, who's going to have his photograph in the frontispiece, and underneath it's going to read, "Oozing testosterone from every pore, he oiled his way across the floor."
And what is that from?
From My Fair Lady.
Right.
From George
right.
Bernard Shaw.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You were well known to Americans in the 80s, the nuclear sane movement, an enormous movement that I think was one of the movements post-60s that did bring together right, left, women, seniors, mm-hmm. students and all, and had a true effect. I mean, I think
Well,
we
led a revolution. It was the second American Revolution, because when I started in 78, almost every American said to me, it's better to be dead than red. And I said, what, you'd rather die in a nuclear war? Yes, they said, we don't want to be communists. Very proud. So I said, well, what about the pygmies in Africa? And they said, no, it's better that they're dead too. They don't want to be communists. I mean, it was true clinical paranoia, which we're now seeing against the Muslims. Anyway, so well, I got together all these 23,000 doctors and we started dropping bombs on San Francisco and LA and describing the medical effects and millions of people being vaporized, turned into gas, you know. And gradually people just started saying, oh my God, nuclear war is bad for our health. The Catholic bishop said they don't think Jesus would approve too much of nuclear war, you know. I was asked to speak to the National Morticians Association and I said, why do you want me to speak to you? And they said, we don't want to have to embalm radioactive bodies. And I said, well, don't worry, you'll be one yourselves. But I did speak to them, they passed a resolution and, you know, 80% of Americans in 5 years rose up and were opposed to nuclear weapons in the arms race. Now, that was a Gandhian, peaceful, sagacious revolution. It was a second American revolution without a skerrick of doubt, and it brought an end to the Cold War along with Gorbachev's assistance.
So once mission accomplished, and in that case it fairly well was in terms of changing this country's policy of nuclear weapons, then you sort of receded, moved back to Australia, I believe, at some point. What brought about this comeback?
I was asked by a man called Bruce Gagnon, a former Republican Air Force man who works against putting weapons in space, to go down to Florida and go to a conference on the weaponization of space. And I had no idea that America was about to deploy nuclear reactors in space and laser beam weapons to take out cities and fight war from space down to Earth and, quotes, effect very many kills and even put orbiting nuclear bombs up there. So I got such a shock. I thought, oh my God, I better do something. So I wrote that book called The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military Industrial Complex. And it was that conference that impelled me to do that. And so I was back on the track again.
Yeah, so partly it had to do with one person kind of calling
one
you
person.
In. But the other thing was the country had changed.
Absolutely, radically. And I really had a ball writing about Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. I mean, I'm being sarcastic now, but they really are sitting ducks for absolute trenchant criticism. And it's time that we all rose up and used the democracy and spoke the truth. These guys are really, they're the most dangerous administration I've seen in my lifetime, and I'm 68.
Same here. And
they could blow up the planet with a, you know, press of the button, and I don't think they would even care.
Not only that, as they were going down, they'd tell you things were going well.
Oh, absolutely.
You know that.
Oh, yeah. Very well. Yep.
Yep. Now, the book says nuclear power is not the answer. The reason that I assume it has that title is that some people are saying it is, that we're facing peak oil, we're facing global warming. So people are looking for alternative energy sources.
So which people are saying it's the answer, Terry?
Which people?
Yeah.
I have heard politicians.
And?
Some folks, it seems to me.
Who's conducting the propaganda? Who's paying for it?
I would imagine it would be the folks who tend to profit from nuclear power.
The nuclear industry is spending over $200 million in a huge propaganda exercise. Christy Whitman, former head of the EPA, is being paid for by the nuclear industry. And the nuclear industry lies overtly, and I'm sick of them lying. And they're saying they're the answer to global warming. And if you read my book, have you read it, Terry?
No. I've read some of it.
Okay. The first chapter deals with global warming.
Now I know why I like to ask the questions.
Well, you know, I'm a bit experienced. Okay, so, and I'm a doctor, so, you know, I can establish a doctor-patient relationship with you, and you're nailed.
That's
like I did with Reagan. I held his hand in the White House for 9 1/4. Anyway, while assessing his IQ. First, fossil fuel, immense quantities are used to dig up the uranium ore. Then immense quantities are used to crush it, fossil fuel. Then to enrich it, you use two huge coal-fired plants to enrich the uranium, for God's sake. Then you have to build a reactor, huge amounts of fossil fuel. Then after 40 years, it has to be cut apart by remote control by robots, more fossil fuel. Then you've got witch's cauldrons of bubbling, thermally hot, radioactive waste that lasts for 500,000 years, which must be kept continually cooled by circulation of water, more fossil fuel. Then you have to make casks. I love that word because you put a body in a cask. Casks with radioactive waste and transport it thousands of miles to Yucca Mountain in Nevada, transected by 32 earthquake faults.
If they ever allow that to happen.
But what you need to know is huge amounts of fossil fuel are used to do that. If you add up just the front end of the fuel chain, not the back, not the radioactive waste, not the decommissioning, at the moment a nuclear power plant produces 30% of the carbon dioxide as a similar size gas-fired plant. But as uranium declines in concentration within 10 or 20 years, a nuclear power plant will produce the same amount of carbon dioxide as a fossil fuel plant, coal or gas. So you may as well just burn the coal. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I wish, no, I don't wish, they should be tried for lying. I mean, the Earth is in the intensive care unit. You've seen Al Gore's film. We might have 10 years before the ocean levels raise 20 feet, yet people are still driving their SUVs. And the other myth is, oil is not used to generate electricity. Oil is used for transportation. So to say, oh, we've got an oil crisis, we've reached peak oil. Oh, well, you know, we'll have nuclear power. The two don't even intersect.
Yeah, but if you're clever and you say fossil fuel.
No, but that's lying by being clever. Lying is medically contraindicated on a planet that is dying. If I lied in medicine about treating you, I would be deregistered. Rush Limbaugh, I don't believe in freedom of speech when it comes to salvation of 30 million species on the planet.
Yeah, I know. I forget who it was.
So serious.
When someone said everyone's entitled to their opinion.
No, this isn't
an
opinion. No, they're not. We must have scientific data, and the data's out there, as Al Gore so brilliantly lays out in his film, An Inconvenient Truth. My data about the medical effects of nuclear power and its expense and the causes of global warming is in my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. What is the answer? An array of renewables, the technologies here right now, they're cheaper by far than nuclear. We can start implementing them immediately. So every house in America is a solar collector. Every house is a solar hot water system, all subsidized by the federal government. That's what they should be spending money on, not killing people in Iraq for oil, which we've got to stop burning because we're causing global warming. I mean, the politicians are not very bright. That's half the problem.
Well, it depends.
They're shrewd and crafty and devious.
It depends what their goal is. As to whether you think...
Well, what is their goal? It's power.
And it's power and
Henry
re-election.
Kissinger said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. And, you know, it's very serious. We can't be represented. These people are medically contraindicated and must be removed from office for the public health of the people of the planet.
Quite agree. Now, some people, and I said it before and you said name them, but I know that I've been noting it. In other words, I'll hear and I'll go, darn, when I hear someone... You know, that should know better.
You mean James Lovelock, who developed the Gaia theory?
Not just Lovelock. I mean
Patrick Moore, who worked for Greenpeace and now works with Christy Todd Whitlam, being paid by the nuclear industry?
Well, not just him.
Who else?
Stuart
Brand, who founded the Whole Earth Catalog.
Yes.
I don't know where he's coming from, but I'll tell you what. When I spoke at my alma mater to Children's Hospital in Boston at Harvard recently, 100 of the top pediatricians in the world, there wasn't one person who disagreed with me. This is a medical problem, and those others clearly either are being paid by the nuclear industry, so they're prostituted, or they're Faust, you know, they've sold their soul, or they don't understand the medical consequences of the fuel cycle. And I know, because I've taught myself, because I've always been so concerned about this, you see. And so that's why I had to start Physicians for Social Responsibility, to teach my colleagues. Unfortunately, it's not doing much on nuclear power at the moment, except the LA chapter is. It's a fantastic chapter.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
You know, we've got so much work to do. And the key to a democracy is education. If a democracy is not educated, it makes decisions which are very serious.
You said earlier, Thomas Jefferson said, an informed democracy will govern responsibly, and that's why I think we are in such great danger.
Well, and the media
is... As you know, at the 2004 election, after it, they found that a majority of Bush supporters believed that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction.
Well,
a majority of Bush
and
supporters...
And who was responsible for that? Fox. And who owns Fox?
Well, not just Fox. But
Fox, yeah, but it was big-time Fox. Who owns Fox? Murdoch. Murdoch championed me in the beginning of my career in Adelaide when I led the movement against the French tests.
Oh.
He wrote front page editorials on The Australian talking about me.
Because he thought it was anti-French.
I guess he did.
He
and then when I did uranium, he didn't, you know,
right.
He backed away, and that's been it ever since.
What's the story on depleted uranium?
Well, that's just uranium-238, which is not fissionable and is left over from uranium mining and nuclear power. It's free. It's nuclear waste. It's turned into shells of 10 pounds in mass, anti-tank shells, which are shot out at high velocity, which penetrate the other fellow's tank like a hot knife through butter.
Do they penetrate it because of their nuclear part?
No, it's no. Uranium is very dense. It's 1.7 times more dense than lead. And momentum equals mass by velocity. So it's very dense, shot out at high velocity, and being such, it goes straight through the armor of the tank.
So it's the density, not the nuclear piece
exactly.
of it.
Exactly.
Which means, were it not nuclear, it'd be, you know, it might make some...
Yeah, but up to 80% of it burns, producing tiny particles that can be inhaled into the lung. Now,
what have been the health repercussions
of depleted
uranium?
I'll tell you, in 1991, America used 360 tons of this shocking stuff at Basra, near Basra, south of Iraq. My colleagues, pediatricians, noticed an increased incidence of childhood cancer because children are very sensitive to radiation. Now it's gone up 700%, okay? And the incidence of severe, severe congenital anomalies, babies born with no brains, single eyes, no arms, has gone up 700%. Women are too terrified to deliver their babies, and the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years, so America is having a nuclear war in Iraq. And this time they've used probably over 2,000 tons. The Pentagon is lying consistently, what's new, but it's a really, really serious issue.
Now, it also affects our soldiers too, right?
Yeah, of course.
Because they're there and they're all around it. So they're coming back with...
Well, then they excrete the uranium in their semen. Their wives complain of burning semen getting into their vaginas. And some of these fellows are having babies that have severe congenital anomalies too.
Okay. What's an update on what happened as we are many years hence from Chernobyl? What is the current state of that area?
Okay, one third of the core got out during the fire and the meltdown. In the core is as much long-lived radiation as that produced by 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. So that's all over Europe. Right now, 40% of the European landmass is radioactive. Strontium-90, which lasts for 600 years. Cesium-137 lasts for 600 years. Plutonium lasts for 500,000 years. I do not buy European food. You don't know what food is radioactive, and the food concentrates these elements hundreds of times. I don't buy French wine, and it's very, very, very serious. We're seeing a lot of cancers, particularly in Belarus and the Ukraine.
And I just read that the first nuclear power plant in Europe has just in this past week been slated. Someone has said they're going to build the first one in...
No, they're building one in Finland. That's in the book. And it's all covered mostly by government because nuclear power
is
a socialized industry.
Oh. Yeah. What explains all the subsidies of nuclear power?
Oh, because it's an infant of the weapons industry. And so it's just gone on being subsidized by you, the taxpayers.
Based on the notion that there were peaceful uses, and really the peaceful uses were just a PR stunt to allow us to feel a little better about the nuclear
bomb?
No,
they were really to assuage the guilt of the bomb makers who felt so terrible about, you know, blowing up 200,000 people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I knew those fellows. I worked closely with them. And they were addicted to nuclear power in that it help them with their guilt, but underneath they knew how incredibly dangerous it is.
And in terms of us now having, and this is going to be the last question, in terms of us now having these rows with North Korea, Iran, and so on, it always occurs to me that the simplest way to stop the slippery slope of can someone do nuclear power but not nuclear weapons is to get rid of our nuclear weapons and get rid of all nuclear power.
Terrence, you're right on the knocker. Of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, Russia and America own 97% of them. Yet they're running around with a microscope looking at other countries. Talk about hypocrisy. See not the mote in the other person's eye, look instead for the mote in your own eye. This country could lead the world towards sanity and survival by, with Russia, abolishing nuclear weapons in 5 years. Bang. Like
which
that.
Which they agreed to do in the Nuclear Proliferation Pact.
Gorbachev and Reagan almost agreed to do that in Reykjavik. And closing down every single reactor. You've got a special bill that's been passed by your California legislature, signed by your governor, to look at the whole life cycle of nuclear power here. You are 40 miles from a reactor, which if melted down, would destroy much of Los Angeles and kill millions of people. And it could happen tonight. Sweden got to within 2 minutes of a massive meltdown about 5 weeks ago, like Chernobyl. Wasn't in your media, was it?
No, it was
in the world's media. So it's not if but when, but that reactor at Diablo Canyon is built on an earthquake fault. My God, you are in great danger. You had better close that thing down. And people saying, well, how can I do it? You know, write a letter to the paper. You know, an aroused person is unstoppable and can absolutely change this country. And this bill might close those two reactors down.
So again, the book is Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming or Anything Else. The website is www.nuclearpolicyoneword.org. Thank you, Helen Caldicott. Keep up the good work, Doctor.
Yeah, you do it too, or else I'm going to stop.